Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. Again, sorry, the big projector doesn't seem to want to work today. Hopefully no need to remind you, Dan 1 happens here next Tuesday during lecture time. Any organizational questions, issues? Yeah.
We're still going to have a problem set to you,
right? Tomorrow? Tomorrow's problem set is relevant for the exam, so yeah. The question really is, do I hit you next week? And yeah, this is 142, so I'm going to hit you next week, but it will be shorter than usual. And the same for workshop. The exam's on Tuesday, so if it were on Thursday, I'd feel a lot worse about that. But you have, you know, recover for a day and then get back on it. You're good. You're young. What I feel a little more guilty about is you have workshops also on Monday, so I almost canceled workshops, but I made it a bit shorter. One can argue that a lot of the kinds of concepts that you're dealing with as you move forward actually help you with the other stuff too, so I don't really think of it as completely divorced from studying from the exam. Let me use an extreme example on that. The number of times that I have, particularly sort of physics, what comes to mind more, physics 113, 114, students come into my office at the end of the semester completely embarrassed by everything they missed on their first exam. Because somehow, as you continue using this stuff, it all sort of begins to gel, and seeing it in different settings helps clarify concepts early on. So there's a lot to be said for the stuff that may be bothering you right now. You'll begin to find that just you'll get used to it, or the connections will be made, or it'll just seem trivial later on. So anyway, that said, if you really don't want to go to workshop on Monday, go on Tuesday or Wednesday. There are other sections, so feel free to swap around sections. Okay? I looked at the doodle poll, and there was sort of two times where the majority of the class said they could make it. And there were some people that could make one but not the other. So I basically picked a time and bracketed the two, hoping that at least people who could make either of those could come. It's informal, so feel free to come and go as you want. Basically, I'll answer questions until you run out of reasonable questions to ask, and that often happens at about the hour to hour and a half mark. So I'm expecting to be here for an hour and a half, but you know, if nobody shows or you have no questions, then it will be short. But I'm assuming that that's probably not going to happen by that statement. Probably have some questions. So. Okay. Anything about the exam or leading up to the exam? I'm not exactly sure when I'm going to get the exam typed up and ready for you, so I'm not exactly sure when I'll forward the formula sheet to you yet. I sort of have it mostly set up in my head, but I need to sit down quietly and do it and then take it and make sure all the kinks are worked out. So I'm not exactly sure when that will happen. But as I say, if you want to know what the formula sheet will look like, if you look at the last couple of, you know, I think it was 2010 is the last time I taught this class, and probably the year before that. So if you look at the exam bond formula sheet for those, you have a pretty good idea of what it looks like. Okay, so last time we covered a lot, actually, in terms of takeaways, things that you'll end up needing to use a lot. And so this summarizes it a bit. we talked a lot about capacitance, and we looked at a very particular geometry, and we looked at if you have charge and you have a potential across parallel plates, then you can actually solve for the capacitance in terms of those quantities. And when you do, you find that it depends only on geometry. Epsilon not a constant, the area of the parallel plates divided by the distance. And this definition, or this formula to describe the capacitance, is specific to this geometry. This geometry is sort of the canonical capacitor geometry. So you will find this particular geometry and model of it to be quite useful. That said, any system with conductors where you're putting charge on them will have a capacitance. And that capacitance is geometry specific. So you could imagine needing to actually derive the geometrical expression for the capacitance in some other configuration. And if we were to do that, you would need to, you know, have an expression for the charge and an expression for the potential and actually try to find what that constant is in terms of how it breaks down geometrically. So that will be different for different configurations. Okay. But this one is useful enough that I would always keep it at your fingertips. Very often we'll run into circumstances where we have multiple capacitors, and it's a very useful thing, particularly when you look at complicated circuits, to try to think of multiple capacitors in terms of single capacitors to break down the problem and solve it piecemeal, as we'll begin to do at the end of class today or next Tuesday. Not next Tuesday. Next Tuesday you'll have other things to do. Maybe next Thursday. But for example, if I have a situation where I might put a potential across a conductor here and here, and I have two capacitors that are in parallel, okay? In that case, the capacitance of this thing as a whole is equal to the linear sum of the capacitances. And if I have I capacitors, it would be the sum of C sub I. If they're in series, then you have this reciprocal relationship. And I derived both of those in class last time. And again, you should look at the derivations and make sure you're comfortable with them. But basically, you'll end up just needing to use the formulas a lot. Capacitors, when you put a potential difference across them, they have charge on them. There's an electric field in the region between the capacitive plates. And we extracted or derived the expression for the stored energy in the capacitor. And you can think of it as energy that is stored in the electric field that is formed as you charge the capacitor up. And these are general expressions. They only differ by using Q equals CV in order to rewrite the expression in terms of the different variables. But these all represent the basically the energy that's stored in the capacitor when you charge it up to a certain potential difference or a certain charge. And so, again, you may find different forms useful depending on what you have in a problem. And then finally, probably the most profound thing that we talked about last time, which I think will take on more importance as we move further in the class, is if you think of the electric field in the capacitor as something that's storing the energy that it takes to shove all the charge on there. Effectively, you're doing work to put all that charge on this capacitor, and so it now stores energy in some house. There's a potential energy there. And if you interpret that potential energy as being stored in the electric field, we derive that the energy density within the electric field goes as this epsilon naught over 2 times the magnitude of the electric field squared. But in extracting that, we used a very particular geometry. But what we ended up with is something that doesn't have anything geometrical in it. It has only something about the electric field. So if you have an electric field out in free space, there is energy there. There's an energy density that's associated with the electric field. So if you believe in electric fields, then it turns out they also have energy in them. Okay. Any questions on that stuff? All right, so given the fact that you have an energy density in the electric field, you could ask what is the energy stored in any given system that you've coupled the electric field in, and if you're able to determine the electric field, then knowing what the energy density is, you can determine the energy stored in the system, the electrostatic energy stored in the system by integrating the electric field density over the whole volume of electric field. So very powerful. So then we shifted gears. We've been talking about electrostatics in a vacuum, and we shifted gears and began to look at what might happen in materials. And in a conductor, at least at this stage of the class, probably through most of this class, you will think of a conductor as being where the charge can flow freely, which means if you have an electric field, the charges will flow until the electric field is zero. And for the most part, we think of that happening instantaneously, although well, as we begin to talk about current and things, we're actually gonna start looking at modifications to that even today. But for the context of this discussion, assume for a conductor the charges just flow freely, the electric field is zero. So what happens if you have a different material, one where the charges really can't flow freely? And it turns out that materials come in all different types, but in general you can think of them breaking down into two types of categories. One being one where the material itself is made up of inherent little dipoles. Water is an example. And generally they're in random orientations that's enforced by kinetic motion and whatever's happening in the material. But then if you put an electric field on it, there will be a torque that will begin to try to align these dipoles. And the degree to which those dipoles get aligned will depend on two things. One is the material itself, so that is how strong are the dipoles and how easy is it to actually twist them in the material itself. And there are lots of things that may depend on. It may depend on the nature of the material. You know, if it's a gas and there's a lot of energy in there, there's a lot of motion and there are molecules all hitting each other and knocking each other out of alignment. If you're in a crystalline lattice of some form, it may be that there are constraints of other molecules in the area within the crystalline lattice that will try to hold things in place. So different materials have a different susceptibility to this. The other thing that it will depend on is the size of the electric field. It doesn't matter what the material is. If there's a large enough electric field on there, I can rip those molecules apart. Okay, so in a sense, I can make something happen if E gets big enough. Okay, we will typically work in a regime, and we will really only consider in this class, what we call linear dielectrics, which is the degree to which I get the alignment of these dipoles is going to be linearly dependent on the strength of the electric field. And we will stay away from the regime where we destroy the material by putting in a big electric field. And you could imagine in materials that you may have nonlinearities at times, and you may have something where the dipole can't move along the electric field, but is forced to move at some weird angle because of some weird structural thing in the material. Those things all happen, but we're going to ignore those. And it actually is useful to a very good approximation. So it's sort of like pendulum is a pretty good simple harmonic oscillator that you can understand so long as you don't make the angle too big. If you make the angle really big, then your understanding of it doesn't really work, but it's a very useful tool. So in that sense, linear dielectric approximation is a very good tool, and I think it's quite useful in many regimes for many materials. You can have a different type of material, one where there is no inherent dipole. If you just look at the things that make up the material, there's a symmetry in the charge distribution. But if you now apply an electric field, you can break that symmetry because what you'll do is basically force some of the electron charge density to drift a little, and you end up with a slight slight asymmetry in the distribution. And that then forms a dipole, which you would call an induced dipole. And again, the degree to which you get induced dipoles, or the size of the induced dipole, is going to be dependent on the magnitude of the electric field. And the stronger the electric field, the bigger the thing. And we will again work in the regime where we assume that there's a linear dependence between the degree to which we get these dipoles formed or induced and the strength of the electric field. This picture, we no longer really care what's going on microscopically. We're going to work in a regime where we will either rotate inherent dipoles or form induced dipoles, and either way we're going to assume that degree to which those things are formed or oriented is linearly dependent on the strength of the field. So we'll now absorb all that microscopic stuff into some constant that describes the degree to which this material allows the alignment to happen. And for the most part, we won't actually end up caring whether it's polar or nonpolar. Okay, any questions about that? The other thing, just to remind you, if people talk about a dielectric, they're really just talking about a non-conducting material. Just keep that to yourselves. We don't want it getting out. All right. So what does this mean in the real world? Well, if we have some electric field in space, which I will represent by saying have two parallel plates, and the reason that we use that is because it has a very well-defined electric field that's easy to understand. But let's suppose that we have such a thing. And now let us imagine that in some region of this space where we have such a well-defined electric field, we put a dielectric. So that would be this blue material. And what we just said was that, in fact, we will induce or orient dipoles that will sort of look like this. And what you'll notice is there's an orientation to this. If the electric field is that way, and I have a dipole, the positive charge goes that way, and the negative charge goes that way. So you imagine that multiplies. So what you end up with is sort of positive charge over here in the direction the electric field is going, because it's pulling the charge that way. Negative charge over here. And if you now consider the field due to the induced charge, it's going the other way inside the material. And the field inside the material is a superposition between this external field and the induced field, going in opposite directions. If it is a conductor, that separation of charge is large enough until those fields absolutely cancel out. The field from the external thing and the field internally have to cancel to give you the field of zero inside the conductor. In a dielectric, that cancellation is partial because you don't do a full separation of charge. You only can do some separation of charge. That means this induced electric field in the opposite direction is somewhat weaker than the field that's going, the external field. So inside the material, we say we have a field E, and that is now going to be weaker, so you have fewer field lines here, than this external field. And when we say that we have a linear dielectric, what we really mean is that the field inside the material is proportional to the external field. And that proportionality is linear. So generally what we say is that E is equal to E naught divided by a constant, which is some big kappa. And kappa is defined as the dielectric constant. And this varies by material. So mathematically, we now have what I was describing in words, which is we have a linear relationship between the field inside the material and the external field, and there is a constant of proportionality that is material dependent. And we call this constant of proportionality the dielectric constant. So if this number is, generally this number is greater than 1, actually. It's greater than 1, which means that when you induce a little bit of charge, you're weakening the field a little bit. If it is 1 or almost 1, so air instead of the vacuum, then you find that that weakening is very, very small. This is almost 1 or basically 1.00000 whatever. And that says that air, for example, in an air gap, is almost the same as having a vacuum. You don't really see a weakening of the field. But if this is, you know, 2 or 80, like you have in water, then in fact, when you insert water in here, you've reduced the field substantially. So just to get some examples here, cap of water, the dielectric constant of water is equal to 80.4 of air, it's 1.00054 for the vacuum. In the non-quantum world, this gets modified when you start taking into account quantum mechanics and large charges and things like that, but we won't worry about that in this class. This is 1. If you put oil in the gap, it has a dielectric constant of 4.5. Is this making sense? Yes.
Is that distilled water, or is that like water?
I assume since they said just water, it would be distilled water. Clearly, if you put more crud in there, like salt, and you would change this a lot, potentially. All right. So I hope you're comfortable with this. It's not bad, right? This is easy. What's wrong with it?
Evidently something.
Come on. Anybody can do this.
You have thought of it. Is it only for this geometry?
Actually, no. This is general. No. But yeah, thanks for bringing that up. No, I'm I'm being obnoxious right now, actually. This is really far too easy, right? It's very simple. I have a field. It has a linear change in the material that reduces the field. I have a very straightforward relationship. The name even makes sense, right? I'm discussing how I change the field linearly in a material. We've already complicated a little bit by calling it a dielectric instead of non-conductor. But if I have to change it and it's linear and it's proportional, I'll have a constant called a dielectric constant. So this all makes sense. Okay? We can't have that. We just can't have that. So, take out your special decoder rings. We are going to define the dielectric constant times epsilon naught, which I'll remind you is called the permittivity of free space. And this is defined as epsilon, which is called the permittivity. So that is the permittivity of a material with a dielectric constant kappa. So, if you want to know how this field is changing, you can find a table, and that table might be a table of dielectric constants, it might be a table of permittivities. In a vacuum, K is 1, and so you just have epsilon naught, which is why it is the permittivity of free space. If you have a kappa because you have a material that actually can undergo this process, then kappa is no longer 1, and you will have a permittivity that is not the same as epsilon naught. So the permittivity of a material is different from the permittivity of free space. And so now the utility of this is that you can sort of use the permittivity in a material in the same way that you're used to using the permittivity of free space. This can be a little bit confusing, so you're going to have to learn to go between the two, but let me give you an example. If we have a parallel plate, and inside the parallel plate system, we shove a bunch of material, and you pretend that I've filled the region. So we know that if I haven't put the stuff in there, or it's a vacuum, we know that the electric field in this region of space is equal to sigma over epsilon naught. We know that the electric field in the material, taking into account the induced dipole, is going to be E0 divided by kappa, which is equal to sigma divided by kappa epsilon naught, and that we can redefine as sigma over epsilon. And so now you can sort of see that you can take an expression that describes something you understand in a vacuum and substitute in the permittivity instead of the permittivity of free space, and you have an equation that works that describes the field inside the material. I think what I would suggest is that you get happy thinking of it that way sometimes, which is you do that substitution and you're happy with it. And I would also get used to going through this process to make sure that you get the same thing. Because I personally have found it sometimes confusing, and it helps if I just sort of use one to confirm the other. I'm not right now remembering the particular circumstances under which I find those confusions to arise, but I will do my best to assign such problems to you next week. You can discover them as I rediscover them. Okay. But that is my suggestion to think of that. But now I hope you sort of understand this whole idea of why we go call it the permittivity of free space, because basically it's a constant that you can use in this way, where in free space you would use the permittivity of free space, and whatever that equation is, if you substitute in the permittivity for a given material, you would have what you would have for the field in a material. Alright? Which you may not, I mean, I think what I don't like is just doing that line substitution. I think I'm much more comfortable thinking of it like this to make sure I feel like I understand it. So you'll have to find your own comfort zone in that. So this can have, you know, big implications. Let's suppose that we have a capacitor, but we have not attached it to a battery. But we know that capacitor is equal to Q equals CV. All right, so what I mean is it's not attached to a battery. It's not at this very moment attached to a battery. Maybe I've deposited charge on it and disconnected it or whatever. So I know that there's a potential to go from one plate to the other, which is the electric field times the distance, right? That's the work per unit charge it takes to go from one plate to the other. If I have material in there, so I put a dielectric in this capacitor instead of leaving it in a vacuum, now that field is different. It's modified by a kappa. So if I ask, with the material inside the capacitor, how much work does it take to go from one point to another, from one plate to another? It's reduced because the field is now weaker. So E goes to E over kappa, which means the potential goes to the potential that I had divided by kappa. So so what I'm saying is, if I have a capacitor and I have it charged and in a vacuum it has a potential V, if I now put in a dielectric, that potential goes to V over kappa. If it has a capacitance, well, it does have a capacitance, and it has a given amount of charge, but I don't have it connected to the battery, which means charge isn't flowing. It's got however much charge it's got. Then I could ask, how does the capacitance change? Well, as I put in a dielectric, Q has to stay the same. The potential goes as V over kappa, which means, with no dielectric, I know that I have a capacitance C. If I have a dielectric, Q is equal to C prime, I'll call it, times the new V, which is V over kappa, which means Q over V times kappa is equal to C prime, and this is what I call C. So the capacitance goes as kappa times C. And for a parallel plate, remember that kappa is kappa, but C is epsilon naught times A over D, and so this is equal to epsilon A over D. So what you'll notice is that the capacitance, which contains the permittivity of free space, this epsilon naught, for a capacitor goes as epsilon naught A over D, and when I look at what it is if I put material with permittivity epsilon in there, it's the same expression, but now I have epsilon instead of epsilon naught. Okay? Any questions about electric fields and materials? So the rest is the same. I mean, Gauss still works. And so a lot of the rest is the same, but the fields depend on what's going on and how it's asked. So. All right, so I want to move on a little bit to look at what happens if we put an electric field in a conductor, but we force the electric field to stay non-zero by putting a battery across it. All right, so let us imagine that we have a wire made of conducting material. And on this wire, I put it across a battery. Now, remember what the EMF does is it puts a constant potential difference between its poles. So if I connect this wire across that, that's going to be constant even if things are happening in the wire. So it's sort of very different from having some external field with a conductor that doesn't have charges that are allowed to flow through some sort. There's nothing that's forcing the potential to be the same. So if I have, for example, let us think for a moment about what's happening in this. If I have electrons in this material, they'll flow. And they'll flow because there's a net charge, there's net potential, there's a field inside the material. So I can imagine that I have a little cross-sectional area where I observe the electrons going through, and I count how many of them go through per second, and I can call that a current. So again, there's a little problem here in that this sort of makes sense. Everybody knows that if you have some crystalline lattice, that the negative charges are doing the moving. Okay? So we choose the opposite convention for clarity. So we choose the direction of positive current flow. Ooh. Is the direction that positive charge would move. Okay? And that stupid little point will you'll just find annoying here and there, because we very much have in our minds the idea that when we talk about current, it's electron moving. So that will always be sort of this intuition that's buried in there. But the moment you try to translate that into anything in physics, the direction of positive current flow is the direction that positive charge would flow, regardless of whether positive charges are actually moving or not. It could well be the negative charges are going the other way. Same effect. Okay? Now, we do have someone we can blame for this one. Benjamin Franklin. I forget the story now, but he basically had to make a choice. And he chose wrong. All right? But what do you want? He used to sit around naked in his house all the time, so who knows. At any rate, so that's important to keep that in mind. All right, now, there's another effect that's happening here, which is let's think for a moment now, let's think about the electrons doing the moving. What's actually going on is you now have lots of atoms, and in the metal, usually the atoms, the molecules of the nuclei have some crystal lattice or whatever where they're sort of stuck. And so what's happening is the electrons basically are moving, and you could imagine a picture where you think of the electrons as little BBs that are moving through this lattice work. And, you know, so what's going to happen is they'll run into nuclei and lose some energy. So there's an analogy I'd like to use for this. Imagine what would happen if you walk out on the quad right after class and you see your sweetheart on the stairs up in Rush Street. Okay? And they're giving you the sweetie wave and you want to go get a hug. Okay? So you go trucking toward Rush Street. And if there are not that many people out of the quad, if you go straight toward them, you might sort of run into one person, okay? And that's not too bad, but you can make it over there, get your hug, and life is good. But imagine if now this is graduation, okay? The quad is completely mobbed with people, and you walk out of Hoyt, and you look over at Rush Reese, and there's your sweetie off in the distance. And you then try to run and get your hug. You're going to be running into people left and right constantly. You're going to lose a lot of energy on the way. Your direction's going to change, and it's going to take you a while to work your way through. Okay? That is what we call resistance in conductors. Resistance, if you don't understand it, just think of electrons looking for love. Electrons looking for love. That's what it is. So, resistance impedes the electrons as they look for love. All right. Different materials might effectively have different populations on the quad. They might be harder to work through. Also, sort of the bigger the electric field, the more you're sort of going to force the issue. Okay? But if you really love your sweetie and you really need that hug and you run a lot faster, you may eventually get there, but you're going to now run into a lot more people, and it'll be problematic. You'll lose a lot more energy trying to get there than you would if you slowly walked and people sort of avoided you because you had that glazed look in your eye or whatever it is. So, all right. So I is defined as dq over dt at some point in the circuit. It's in units of Coulomb per time, per second, and we define that as an ampere, named after, like we do with all of our units, some old physicist, and we'll probably talk more about him later. So, as you might imagine, the current that you should get in something should be proportional to the field that you put in there, because you're going to be pulling the electrons harder and harder, or the positive charge if we want to start thinking in terms of that. So you might expect the current to be proportional to the potential that you put across the wire. And in fact, we say that V is equal to I times R, where R is that constant of proportionality. So in mathematical terms, resistance is really that constant of proportionality. It is the degree to which you get a current for a given potential. If I have a very high resistance, then to get a given current, I have to have a very high potential. So for you to run across the quad when there are a lot of people there, it's much harder than it is if there are few people there. So if I have a low resistance, then I can get a high current for a small potential. Okay? And resistance we put in units of ohms, and this is known as Ohm's law. It's a linear relationship. So it looks something like that. If I have lower resistance, then I get more current for a lower voltage. And if I have a higher resistance, then to get a given current, I have to have a higher voltage. Okay. So one of the things that I think will be in the problem set actually this week is something called resistivity. So you can imagine that I can have a wire, but I can now give it a bigger cross-sectional area. And if I do that, then I also have the ability to sort of generate more current for a certain potential difference. So you will be looking at how resistance changes with material and how it can also depend on the geometry a little bit. So in general, when you see a drawing of a circuit, so what we just said is these conducting wires that connect the different pieces in the circuit, we said they might actually have a little bit of resistance to them. They're real materials. That said, typically you don't actually worry about that. There will be you will see in your problem sets and maybe workshop problems, there are some problems that will be very particularly designed where they tell you you're actually worrying about the resistance of the conducting wire itself. Typically what happens is in the problem, you have different circuit elements connected and you ignore the resistance of the wires that connect them. So you think of those as sort of resistance-free. And what you do is you compartmentalize the resistance into various components in the circuit itself, which we call resistors. And it's a good approximation in a real circuit, because in a real circuit, when you want something that has resistance, you in fact do have something that has a lot more resistance than your typical wire, and you put it in as a circuit element. And compared to the resistance of the wires, it's much bigger. So it's a good approximation to assume you only need to worry about that. Okay? I forgot to do a demo. I want to do it. Let's look up and do that. Okay, so I have the same old electroscope we've used, where I have it's a conductor, and then there's this gold leaf that's hanging straight up here because of the optics. Right? And what will happen is I have this pole, this conductor is connected to these two flat plates. These represent passive plates. And so if I deposit charge on these, on one of these, then you want it to stay up. All right. Fairly dry, you can actually see the charge bleeding off, which happens if this sort of lift. So I'm going to have to do this a little bit fast. Right now I just have air between the can. So what I want to do is to deposit a charge on this thing. And then I'm going to deposit a dielectric, though I touched it. This isn't going to work very well, I have a feeling. Okay, so there it is. Now I put a dielectric in there. Take the dielectric out. Put the dielectric in. Put the dielectric out. Okay, so what's happening? When the dielectric is out, I have the charge distributed in such a way. When I put the dielectric in, clearly some of this charge goes back onto the plates. So, can you make any sense of that? What's going on? What do you think?
You induce electric field from the dielectric and induces the overall charge field in place.
I've reduced the overall electric field inside, so that reduces the potential.
Oh, and if the potential drops,
another way to think about it is I've increased the capacitance. So if I've increased the capacitance, then it means the plates can basically hold more charge. So they effectively will, some of the charge will go back onto the plates. But you can see there's a big effect. So in fact, if you're designing capacitors, capacitors are very important in the real world because you really do use them to store energy in circuits, and we're going to see the dynamic behavior of what that does to currents and things as we look at the circuits in the next week and a half. But you can also use them literally to store energy and stuff. And if you're building a capacitor, one of the things you can do is actually put a dielectric between the plates, because it actually increases the capacitance, which means for a given potential difference, you can store more and more charge. So it's a useful thing to do. Okay. nuts. All right, so the resistance we can think of in circuits as in little compartments. So if we draw a circuit with resistance, we usually symbolize the resistance as this squiggly line. If we have a potential across this resistor, which we do because we have it across this AMF, so that will hold. We ignore the resistance of these wires unless told otherwise, any problems. And so that means we have a potential across this resistor. The electrons will move, and so the amount of work per unit charge it takes to go across this resistor is equal to Q times the potential difference across it. And if I take the derivative of the work, that's going to be the derivative of QV. V is constant, so this is just dQ dt times V, which is going to be I times V. So if I take a resistor and I put a potential difference across it, current will flow, and there'll be an amount of work that's done to get it through the resistor, which is going to be equal to the current times the potential difference. And just to remind you that this is power. So we end up with that the power is equal to I times V, or I can rewrite I in terms of V over R. What's happening is that if I have a resistor and I force current to go through it, it's like you running across the quad. If you're going to run across the quad, whether there's a bunch of people there or not, you're just going to run into them. You're going to lose energy and you're going to knock them around. And so that's what the current is doing in the resistor. And so literally what is making it hard to shove the current through the resistor is, you can think of it as knocking into lattice points and stuff in the circuit and giving it more kinetic energy, which translates as heat. So this is what you would call the dissipative power in a resistor, or resistive heating. When you take a coil, if you have a hot water heater or whatever, there's basically just a high resistance wire, and you shove it, you put a big potential difference across it, and you shove a lot of current through there, and you generate this power. It's quantitative because it's a pretty efficient form of generating heat, and that power is basically heat output. And this is, in fact, one of the issues with trying to make circuits small so you can put a lot of computing power on chips, is that source of power, the heat that you generate by having current go through these wires and stuff, will actually melt the computer chip if you put too much of it all in one place. So when your laptop gets hot, that's this. When the fan dies and the laptop then melts down, that's what you have to think. So circuits are usually a little more complicated. So imagine if we have a circuit that looks like this, where I hold these two wires at a potential difference of V. And let's say that I have a current I that runs through that wire. One of the things that is an analogy you may find useful in thinking about current flow in circuits is think of water flowing through a system of pipes, because the current is it's conservative. Flow is conserved. If I have, you don't compress current just like you don't compress fluids. So if I come in with so much water on one end of the pipe, I have that much water that leaves the pipe. So the same thing happens in circuits. If I have that current flowing in the left-hand wire, I have to have that current coming out on the right-hand wire. Otherwise, I have some buildup of charge, and that's not how it works. But there in the middle, I have a branch point, and that current can slip. And the degree to which the current goes on one branch or the other depends on how hard it is to flow through each of those branches. And that depends on the resistance. If the resistances are the same, then you'll have the same current flowing through the same the wires by symmetry. But if they're different, then you're going to have different currents. Do you have a question?
Yeah. Does it always do that? The same current comes up as the system? Does the circuit never lose any current?
Well, like everything in physics, in the real world, you know, I have to stop and think. You certainly lose energy, but whether you can have current bleed off is sort of a different thing. I don't know. I've not heard of such a thing, but there probably is some mechanism where something strange can happen like that. So you should bear in mind this thought and think of the current as sort of water flowing. That means it splits at branch points, and you have to take into account what's happening at each branch point. So that means this current will flow like this, and I'll have an I1, and let's say that this has resistance 1 here, and this is resistance 2. And I'll have an I2, and I2 is not necessarily equal to I1. In fact, unless the resistances are equal, they almost certainly won't be. So this is a situation where we have resistors in parallel. And it might be interesting to ask what this would look like if I imagined this whole thing to be encapsulated by a shoebox or something, and I'll call that total resistance R. So if I ignore the fact that I have these two internal branches and I think of this thing in a shoebox, then I understand what's going on, because it's just like what we have. We have one resistor and V is equal to IR. So I know that V is equal to I times big R in that sense. Note also that the potential across these two wires is the same as the potential across this little resistor and that little resistor, because they're all connected by conductors. So this conductor is the same, and this conductor is the same. So that means we have the same potential across one resistor and across the other resistor. And by conservation of current, I know that I is equal to I1 plus I2. So I can rewrite the I's in terms of V's and R's. So this becomes V over big R is equal to V over little r1 plus V over little r2. the V's cancel out, and I get that 1 over R is equal to 1 over R1 plus 1 over R2. And so I can generalize this up to N R's. For resistors in parallel, the total resistance, 1 over the total resistance, is the sum of 1 over all the little resistors. Okay? Could imagine having resistors in series. And now they all share the same pipe. So I have a certain potential difference across the ends of the pipe, and I can imagine that I have three different resistors, R1, R2, R3, and I can think of this as maybe being one resistor, which is big R. And we know that if we think of it as one resistor, there'll be a current that flows, which I'll call current I. But if that current I is flowing in the pipe, these resistors are all in the same pipe. So that same current has to flow through each resistor and come out the other side because they're in series. So that means I now know the resist. I know the current through each of the resistors. They're going to be the same. Note that the potential V represents the work per unit charge it takes to go from here to there. The work, the energy that you have to put into it is expended in the resistor. So the work that it takes to go from this point, if the resistances weren't there, this would all be, there'd be no work to go from here to here. Right? So it is the fact that you have resistances in here that allows you to actually have this potential difference, along with whatever is generating it on the other side. But you maintain a potential difference across here because of the fact you have resistors there. So the amount of work it takes to shove charge from here over to here is going to be the sum of the amount of work it takes to take that same charge and shove it through that resistor, plus that resistor, plus that resistor. Because that's basically the same statement. So you can imagine that I have a potential drop here, which I call V1, a potential drop across here, which I call V2, and a potential drop across here, which I call V3. So V1 would represent the amount of work per unit charge it takes to move charge through resistance 1. And V2, similar for resistance 2, and V3, similar for resistance 3. So V is equal to V1 plus V2 plus V3. V can be rewritten in terms of IR. V1 is the same I, but it's R1. V2 is the same I, but it's shoving through R2. And V3 is the same I shoved through R3. The I's cancel out. Big R is equal to R1 plus R2 plus R3. For resistors in series, the total resistance is equal to the sum linearly of all the resistances. Easy. All right? Now, as easy as this is, nature has conspired. We don't have to make up special words for this one because nature has conspired to make it confusing for us. Here's why. What we just showed is that for resistors in series, R is equal to the sum over I of each R. And for resistors in parallel, 1 over big R is equal to the sum of 1 over the little r's. And if you look back at your notes, you will recall that for capacitors, we found that the total capacitance is equal to the sum of the little capacitances, and 1 over the capacitance is equal to the sum over the little capacitances, if you're in series. So I hope you can see from this the source of obvious confusion. You'll have to find your own way to sort through this. I mean, you're welcome to put it on your sheet when the time comes. It's not on the upcoming exam. But in the heat of doing a problem, you have to pull something out, and you're not going to always be going back and looking at these things. So it's good to develop a way to think your way through this and just keep it in mind. Here's the way I think about it, okay? When I face a capacitor problem or a resistor problem, and I have to find some larger, some capacitance of the little pieces or resistance made up of little pieces, here's the way I think about it. May work for you. You have to develop your own way. The one I can remember and makes the most intuitive sense to me is this one, okay? If I have a wire and I want to give it resistance, I put in a resistor. If I want to give more resistance, I just put in more resistors. That just makes sense to me. It takes more work to shove the water through this pipe if I put more crud in the way. Okay? That's what I think. If I remember this one, then I know it's resistive and it's in series. So that means I know if I do resistors in parallel, it's the reciprocal relationship. And I know capacitors are flipped from that, which means if this one is linear, then it's the parallel for capacitors is linear, and it's the reciprocal for the series. So that may sound unwieldy, but it is honest to God the process I go through every time I look at some stupid problem and I'm having to do this. So you figure out what works for you. Maybe if you're very visual and you can see that in your mind, it's good for you. But all right, have a good weekend.
Yeah.
So what you want to do is go in.